At this time, a call upon Kevin Hunter to lead us in speaking on Can We Trust the Bible's Ethics?
Good evening, everyone.
I'm connected. Let's pull this over. As I was telling Brother Clyde before I started, this is just so that I can find an excuse to think while I write something on the board and figure out what my next point is going to be. Thank you all for coming out. It's good to see you on Super Bowl Sunday. And I didn't actually forget to check on the way in. I'm not actually sure where the game is at right now. The question we're going to talk about tonight of whether we can trust the Bible's ethics is, I guess, a critical question to me, because the message of the Bible, or what the Bible teaches, is completely incompatible with any other belief system or message that's out there. There's no alignment of the Bible, there's no partial alignment of the Bible with other ways of thinking. It's very much an all-or-nothing type of teaching. Just to illustrate Mark chapter 12, a passage that we know well, you don't have to look this one up. It says, "One of the scribes came up and heard them disputing with one another, and seeing that he answered them well, asked him, 'Which commandment is the most important of them all?' And Jesus answered, 'The most important is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind and with all your strength.'" So the message of this book, the God of this Bible, is not a God who's interested in our tithes or our clothing or our church attendance or our little surface things like that. The God of this book is a God who wants our very souls. He wants our minds. He wants our heart, our strength. He wants everything from us. And so, if we're going to go there, if we're going to follow this God, we do have to consciously look at the way of life that he wants us to be part of, and we have to decide if we can agree with it. We have to ask ourselves that question: can I trust the way the Bible wants me to live? So my objective tonight is really just to highlight that question for you. In a 50-minute talk, I'm not going to be able to convince you to trust the Bible's message. I think it's a question we need to ask ourselves all the time. We need to read, and we need to say, can I trust the way that the authors of this book, which we believe is God, want me to live? When we first went down to Ecuador, we would go down and do a weekend, and we would do 8 talks of various doctrines. And there's a brother who came out to one of the first talks, and the reason he attended was because within the church he was attending, there was about to be a split. And the reason for the split was that one group within his church thought that when Jesus came back, the earth would be destroyed, while another group within his church thought that the earth would remain. So he saw some titles, and he thought he would come out to our talks and see whether we could sort him out on that, whether we could give some clarity on would the earth be destroyed or would it remain. So he came, and he attended 8 talks, and he came up afterwards to me, and he said, "You know what, I came here to try and get clarity on just one question, and you destroyed everything I believe in. And I'm going to have to change every doctrine that I have." He came back to me 4 or 5 years later, after he'd become a member of our ecclesia down there, and he said, "You know what? A few years ago, I came up to you and I said, to be part of this, I'm going to have to change all my doctrines." And he's like, "I had it totally wrong. I'm going to have to change everything." And he got it. That is what this is asking us to do. It's not just asking us to change what we do on Sundays, are asking us to change a few things here and there. It's asking us to change everything about who we are and what we believe and the way that we act. So we need to decide. Can we align ourselves with this? Come with me to Exodus chapter 20. And I just want to make it very clear what the stakes are here, that this is, in fact, an all-or-nothing kind of thing. We need to decide if we're on the same page as the God of this book. And so Exodus chapter 20, verses 1 to 3, the Ten Commandments. So I'll ask a few of you to help me with reading. If you're uncomfortable, just let me know, and I'll pass you by to someone else. But maybe Matt, if you could read Exodus 20, verses 1 to 3, please.
"And God spake all these words, saying, I am the Lord thy God, which have brought thee out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage.
Okay, so what is the starting point of the Ten Commandments? Before he gets into any of the other details about how we should behave, what does he say to us? Who he is and? Okay, so I am the Lord your God. I brought you out of the land of Egypt. And what is the first commandment, the starting point of any kind of relationship we want to have with God? Okay. Okay. Jesus said the same thing. Yeah, there's one God. And he says right up front, there are no other gods. So it's not, if you're trying to worship this God along with other things in your life, it's not a very compatible message, not a very friendly message to other ways of thinking. There is one God. And this is how he starts off his relationship with us. Now, we might say, well, this is the God of the Old Testament, and he's very strict and hard line. But if we jump to John chapter 10, for instance, and we look at the words of Jesus, who's very much in modern times, and we might think is a softer message or a more compassionate or a more merciful message, just look quickly at a couple samples of the things that Jesus says. John chapter 10, verses 7 and 8, for instance. Art, if you could read that for me, please. John 10, verses 7 and 8.
Therefore Jesus said again, I tell you the truth, I am the gate for the sheep. All who ever came before me were thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them.
Okay, so what does Jesus say about other people? You know, the sheep are the people who would follow a leader or a spiritual leader, and other people who came before him.
Thieves and robbers.
Yeah. So he's not saying I'm one of many. He's saying I am the one. In verse 16 here, he says, I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. So who is he talking about? When he talks about one flock, one shepherd, who is the shepherd? He's talking about himself. He's not waffling. Very clear. There is one flock, there is one shepherd, and I am that person. John chapter 14, verses 6 and 7. John 14, 6 and 7. And John, if you could read, please. 14, 6 and 7.
And Jesus saith unto him, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man cometh unto the Father but by me. If ye had known me, ye should have known my Father also. And from henceforth ye know him and have seen him.
Okay, so he says, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the life. No one comes to God except through me. Now, this is a carpenter from a no-name town in a subdued people, and he, without any sign of self-doubt or fuzziness, says there is one God, and there is one way to that God through me. There's 1,000 nations at this point in time, and they all have their priests and their druids and their shamans, and there's a million people who are talking about ways to get to God, and Jesus says clearly, there is one way. There is one God, and you will get to him through me. And so we've picked just a couple messages here at the very beginning and near the end. But if you read the Bible, it is permeated with this type of assertiveness. Like, how many times does the Bible say, thus says the Lord, or this is what God says? It's literally thousands of times. We can't patronize the authors of this book by thinking, oh, well, they wrote a lot of nice things. We can't just pick up the Bible and go, oh, that was beautiful, or that was deep, or that was profound. These men honestly believe themselves to be writing on behalf of the one God. And what they were writing about was not just some guidance for our lives. We have to be clear that the message of the Bible is highly invasive and personal. God is not just talking about marriage. He's not just talking about raising children. He's not just talking about how we think. He's telling me how I should conduct myself in my marriage. And he's telling you that. And he's telling you and me how we should raise our children. And he's telling us how to think. The Bible is not a book that we can just pick up and take as some sort of abstract feel-good message. We have to decide if we agree what they're saying, because they're not intending their message to be just pretty words or profound words. They're intending their message to penetrate into every aspect of our lives. On the flip side, there's amazing potential here. If this book is true, if the author of this book is who he says he is, then he is someone who lives beyond time and space. He's someone who made us. And if he made us, maybe he knows what I should do in my marriage. And if he actually made us, maybe he has some good ideas about how I should raise my children or how I should conduct myself in my friendships. And so it's a book of, I guess it's a serious book. It's a book that we can't take lightly. We need to decide whether we're going to accept it or we need to decide that we're going to throw it away. But it's not a book that is intended to just be read lightly for entertainment as a series of beautiful thoughts and things to make us feel good when we can't get to sleep at night. Let's look at a couple passages about the potential that lies within this message. So 2 Peter 1. 2 Peter 1, verses 3 and 4. And it says, His divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of Him who called us to His own glory and excellence, by which He has granted to us His precious and very great promises, so that through them you may become partakers of the divine nature. So one of the promises of this book is that we can become partakers of the divine nature. Now, who is speaking here? Who is on behalf of who are these words said? Who do they pretend to be from? They pretend to be from God. This person, Peter, who wrote here, believed himself to be writing on behalf of God, on behalf of the God who created the universe. And that God is not saying, I made everything and you be down there and you do these things for me because I have this busy work that's important to me. This God is reaching out to us and He's saying He wants us to become partakers of His nature. So all the things that are awesome and amazing about God, He's reaching out and He's saying, I want you to be my children and I want to share these things with you. We talk about the power of God. We talk about the life that is in God. Let's look at a passage in John. Jesus talks about this. John chapter 5 again. John 5, 25 to 28. John chapter 5, verses 25 to 28. And someone who hasn't read, Greg. Thank you, Greg.
Most assuredly, I say to you, the hour is coming, and now is, when the dead will hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear will live. For as the Father has life in Himself, so He has granted the Son to have life in Himself, and has given Him authority to execute judgment also, because He is the Son of Man. Okay.
Okay, so if God is who He says He is, then He is the origin of life. And what does Jesus say about that life? What has God done with that life? What does He intend to do with it? Share it with us. So when we talk about the divine nature, there's many aspects of it, but one of them is life. And we'll talk about this for a few minutes later, but life isn't something that God has. Life is something that God is. It's just, it's within Him, and He wants to extend that to us. And so these are the promises that this book extends. This book wants to come into every aspect of our lives. It's asking us to love God with all our strength and with all our mind. with everything that we have. It wants us to guide our marriages by it. It wants us to raise our children by it. It wants us to think according to the way that it says. And it holds out these promises to us. We know the promises to Abraham. We won't look at them now, but it says in Romans 4 that God said to Abraham that he would inherit the world. So the same thing that God said to Abraham is what God says to us. Walk around this place. Get to know it. It's yours. Those are the promises that God extends to us. And he can extend those promises to us because this world is his. It's on the question we have to ask ourselves. So he offers me eternal life. He offers me the world as an inheritance. So for 50, 60 years, I got to behave in a certain way. Is that how he's wanting us to think? So if we put it another way, how much would we have to pay you to raise your child in a way that you didn't think was that good? But, you know, what would be the reward that would motivate you to conduct your marriage in a way that you didn't agree with, or to raise your children in a way that you didn't think was right? So if we do this, it's not for the reward. You know, we're not going to do it just because, well, he offered me life. We're not going to do it because he offers us the world. We have to do it because we believe it. The kind of religion or the kind of belief system that this book is asking us for is not something we can do for a reward. It wants to come into the very core of our souls and us to change who we are. So we have to ask ourselves that question. Can I trust the author of this book? Come with me to Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, and let's read 43 to 48. Matthew 5, 43 to 48. Peggy, would you be able to read that for us, loud and clear? Thank you. So what quality of God is Jesus trying to highlight here for us? When he talks about you shall be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, is he talking about God's behavior particularly, the details of that behavior? What is the definition of perfection that this section is talking about? Okay, it has to do with his character. What aspect of his character? Okay, love. When it talks about perfect, what other word could we put in the place of perfect? Complete. You shall be complete as your Father is complete. But in the context of what he's talking about, he sends the rain on the just and on the unjust and makes the sun to rise on the good and the evil. Fair. Okay. I'm going to say integrity. So this is the reason why I asked for Genesis 1 to be read, because in Genesis 1, there's a few patterns that are repeated. And tell me some of those patterns. So God makes something and okay, it says it was good. And okay, it says he saw that it was good. That appears seven times in that first chapter. Now, why does God say over and over again that what he did was good? What is he wanting us to conclude from that? If this is the God of the universe introducing himself to us, what is he wanting us to come away from that first chapter with? What is he? Who does he want to present himself as? Everything he did was good. He wants us to see that. What is he trying to tell us about himself? He's trying to affirm that he is good. Okay? Like what Jesus says is that God acts according to who he is. And so God is saying, everything I do is good. So I would like you to believe that I am good. And so the very first chapter is inviting us to decide whether we agree with that. It's important for God for us to decide that. For us to decide whether we agree that he is good, that we can trust him. Now, the problem is that the entire Bible is about how we should behave and how, you know, differences of character and differences of behavior. I'm going to just skip lightly across some examples. So the flood, for example, when the flood comes upon the earth, what is the key root cause that is identified for God punishing mankind? What was the behavior that was particularly highlighted? The earth was filled with
violence.
So the God of the Bible presents himself as someone who would stamp out violence. So what are our feelings about violence? Is this something that we can agree with? Can we agree that people should not be beaten up or stabbed in parks, that women shouldn't be raped when they go out for a run, that children shouldn't be harmed? Is this something that we can align ourselves with? So this is how we need to read the Bible. When the God of the Bible says, this is who I am, that when I see violence, it has to be eliminated. Is that something that I can share? Is that a belief that I can align myself with? Or the Exodus. What is the principal theme of the Exodus, the entire book? What does God not want for his children?
Slavery.
So the God of the Bible presents himself as someone who detests slavery, who wants us to be free. Is that a belief system we can align ourselves? Is that something that I can say, yeah, I want to be part of someone who will do anything to get his children out of slavery? Let's look at the Ten Commandments again. Exodus chapter 20. Exodus chapter 20, and we won't read them all, but maybe starting in verse 12, it says, honor your father and your mother, that your days may be long in the land. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. Are these things that we can align myself with? Do I believe that it's a good thing that I should be content with what I have? Do I believe it's a good thing that we should be faithful to each other? That if I've made a commitment to my wife or to my husband, that I should be faithful to them? Does that sound like a value that seems laudable to me? Should I not take other people's things? Should I speak truthfully about myself and about other people? Are these values that we can agree with? Do they make sense to us? Now, Exodus is full of commandments like this, and most of them are set for like an agrarian society many years ago. But if we look at, for example, chapter 21, verses 28 to 30 is one of my favorites. We start to get into more nuances of human behavior here. So Exodus 21, 28 to 30, and do you want to read? That's good. Okay. One more. Okay. So what is this about? You know, project this to our time period. What are the principles in a section like this? Most of us don't have oxen, but... Social responsibility. Okay, so there's certain things that we can do that can happen to us, I guess, but we're not aware of them. So the brakes on my car can fail, and I may injure someone, or I might have machinery at my plant that has never before malfunctioned or never injured anyone, and things can happen, and this kind of sets some limits on our liability in situations like that. But if something is known to have happened or could be imagined to happen, then we have to do something about it, or else we're liable for it. So if there's been dust explosions in mills and we don't keep the dust in our mill, then we have a responsibility for that. Or if we know that brakes can fail in cars if they're not properly maintained, then we need to maintain our vehicle. And so our whole system of permitting and different things like that that exist within our society come back to this type of principle. And if you haven't lived in other countries where they don't have some of those things that we pay taxes for, then you become grateful for them. Because I grew up in El Salvador, and back in the 70s, there was a big mudslide where something washed down from the mountain and wiped out an entire subdivision. And 20 years later, they're building houses there again. So some of these principles are not even found in our societies nowadays, but they're here. If you know something can harm other people, you have to act proactively to avoid it. And so, again, we need to ask ourselves, is this something that I can align myself with? Is this a system of belief that, and of behavior and of human relations that I can agree with? Let's come with me to Job. Job chapter 31 is a useful chapter because Job protests his innocence and he talks about a few things that he believes are good. So Job chapter 31, and he says in verse 1, I have made a covenant with my eyes. How then could I gaze at a virgin? And so this is an older man, a married man with children, and he's trying to tell people that, no, I'm not a blatant sinner, and I don't deserve all these things that happened to me. And so one of the things he says is that I'm faithful to my wife. Is that a value that we could agree with? Again, faithfulness. Verse 5, if I have walked with falsehood and my foot has hastened to deceit, do we think that we should be clear in the way that we speak? Do we think that people should be honest and that they should be truthful? In verse 9, if my heart has been enticed toward a woman. Verse 13, if I have rejected the cause of my manservant or my maidservant when they have brought complaint against me. Verse 16, if I have withheld anything that the poor desired or have caused the eyes of the widow to fail. Verse 24, if I have made gold my trust or called fine gold my confidence. Verse 29, if I have rejoiced at the ruin of him who hated me or exulted when evil overtook him. Verse 38, responsibility to our land and our property. If my land has cried out against me and its furrows have wept together, if I have eaten its yield without payment. These are all the things that Job thinks are the behaviors of a principled person that he holds up as this is what's good. So when we read the Bible, we need to look at these passages and we need to say, does that make sense to me? Does that seem like that is good behavior? Would I do the same? Let's one more, Psalm chapter 15, Psalm 15, 1 to 6. And I'm picking these somewhat at random just to try and present snapshots from different parts of the Bible. So you can see that in the Old Testament, in the Law, and then in the book of Job, and then in the Psalms, and we'll look at some examples from the prophets and from the New Testament. And what I'm trying to express is that I believe that the message of the Bible is consistent. I believe that the value system follows from beginning to end. So Psalm chapter 15, verses 1 to 6, it says, O Lord, who shall sojourn in your tent, and who shall dwell on your holy hill? He who walks blamelessly and does what is upright and speaks truth in his heart, who does not slander with his tongue and does no evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, and who honors those who fear the Lord, who swears to his own hurt and does not change, who does not put out his money at interest and does not take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things shall never be moved. So again, is this the kind of person I want to be? Is this in my marriage, with my children, with my friends? Do I want to be someone who swears to my own hurt and doesn't change? Would I like this to be said about me, that I made a promise and then I realized that it was going to take me 6 weeks to meet that, but yet I honored it? The classic case of Joshua, when they came to him and they tricked him and they said they were from another country far away. And he said, well, you know, I've made a promise. Now I need to honor it. Is that the kind of people that we think we should be? And it's important to realize that the Bible is not a book about, it's not a book about religion and religiosity. It's a book about day-to-day behaviors and interactions with God and with other people. It's a practical guide to how we conduct ourselves, to our ethics, to our value systems, to our beliefs. Let's look at Isaiah chapter 1. So Israel was going off the edge here, and so God sends prophets to set them straight. So Isaiah chapter 1, verses 12 to 17. And Mike, if you could read 12 to 15, please, and maybe Ethan, 16 and 17? No? Okay. Mac, 16, 17? 12 to 15, please. Okay, what was the problem that was happening in Israel right now? At this point. Because? Okay. Okay, so what were the things that they were neglecting? What were the things that were not happening in their lives? Oh, okay, what were the things that were happening? Okay. So, and how does the author of this book seem to feel about that type of lifestyle? Doesn't seem happy, does he? You know, it's like, who asked of you this trampling of my courts? It's like, what are you doing here? And he is not interested in any kind of surface religiosity. It's what Jesus said. He wants our minds and our hearts and our strength and our souls. He wants something that comes from inside, something that we actually believe in and that we practice in the small things of our lives when we seek justice and correct oppression and bring justice to the fatherless and plead the widow's cause. So when we read passages like this, is this the kind of belief system that we can agree with? Or do we think that there should be religion and there should be life and never the twain shall meet, and I should be able to do one thing without it being getting into my life, and I should be able to go to work and do what I need to do at work and not have to worry about ethics and principles and the poor and justice and things like that? Do we like a life that is carefully segmented? Because that is not the religion or the faith or the belief system of this book. This book is everywhere in our lives. The message here is part of everything. And the author of this book is not at all interested in a religion where we show up looking nice and bring the required offerings and we all talk to each other like it's all pretty, but then we go off and do something completely different. So again, God is not happy. The God of this book is not happy with that type of life. Does that seem right to us? Does that seem like something that we can agree with? The God of this book is not interested in scratching his own back, as it were. He's not interested in making his people look good. He chose the people of Israel because he was going to honor a commitment. He makes no... there's no illusions there about him keeping that promise because they were particularly good people. Much the contrary, his faithfulness is highlighted by how evil they were and yet how faithful he was to his promise. Another passage in the prophets, just to pick another example from the prophets before we move to the New Testament, Micah chapter 6. And I won't put you all through what I'm going through, which is trying to find Micah. I'll find it and then I'll read it. So Micah chapter 6, verses 6 to 8. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams and with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression and the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O man, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with your God? Are those values that we can say, yeah, I would like to be part of that? To do justice, to love kindness, to walk humbly. Is that... That's the system of ethics, the system of values, the belief system of this book. Can I believe that? Can I follow that? Come with me to, we're going to have to jump ahead a little bit, but come with me to Matthew chapter 5. And we'll look at a few samples of the words of our Lord, of the type of person that God is looking for. It's interesting, I grew up in a third world macho culture, and Matthew 5, these characteristics are exactly the opposite of what we would be raised as to be men in a third world country. You know, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. It's like, what man is going to be poor in spirit? Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, blessed are the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers. Are these values that we can align ourselves with? This is what the only Son of God says are the things that are blessed. People who are meek, who are pure in their thinking, who are merciful and kind to each other, who suffer with others, who are poor in spirit, who are humble. So as we read this book, we need to be asking that question. Can I trust the person who writes this? Do I want to be part of what he says? And most of the teachings of the Bible aren't flat-out statements of certain qualities like what we've been reading. They're actually a lot more nuanced. They're stories about people and families interacting with each other, and we have to do some work to draw out of them. How did Jesus teach? What was his main method of teaching? Yeah, telling stories. And so Jesus is like his father. And that's how his father teaches. He teaches by telling us stories. And so we have stories of all these different people, and it says in Romans that they're there for our instruction. They're hand-picked stories that are useful for the thorny human interactions that we have in our lives. And some of the challenges in our lives are very complex, and there's stories there for them all. Just to pick an example, hopefully it's not a personal problem for anyone here right now, but problem of polygamy. What's the Bible's approach to something like that? We trace through the Bible. It's complex, isn't it? it's a complex issue. Or the issues, you know, there's a lot of issues in life with raising children, with marriage particularly, and problems in marriage and what happens after that. And the Bible has a lot of very complicated stories about people who are wrestling with some of these things in our lives. And it's not, I think the Bible is a match for the complexity of our lives. The Bible is not a black and white book that expects our lives to be just so. Most of the characters in this book have very messy lives, and that is useful for me because that's an accurate reflection of my own situation. A book that was all about very straight people who never had any struggles in their life, their marriage, their children, their interactions, that wouldn't be such a useful book. This book is not like that. This book has a lot of people like me. And when this book approaches complex issues like polygamy and marriage and raising children, the book is equal to the complexities and the challenges of our lives. So in a 45-minute session, we're not going to be able to dig into any of these. But you need to start somewhere. You start reading it, and when you see that the Bible talks constantly about trust and kindness and meekness and humility and loving and looking after the poor and justice and even more nuanced justice, social justice, we need to ask ourselves, is this something that I can be part of? And in some areas, I find the Bible actually challenging, difficult to accept. Now, how should we feel about that? So maybe that's not the case for any of you. Maybe you all read the Bible and you find it just fine and never question any of the approaches that it takes to certain situations. How should we feel about the fact that the Bible may be challenging to certain aspects that, you know, instinctively we might think are right and wrong? Or does in every case your thinking align with the Bible's thinking? Everyone here is, you're all on the same page as the book, and I'm the only one who's... there's a quote that I really like. It's attributed to Albert Einstein. I didn't track down a recording of him actually saying it, but on the internet it says, we can't solve the problems, we can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking that we used when we created them. And where I'm going with that is that who wants to worship a God who is not challenging? You know, if God's mind is not beyond mine, if it is not difficult to see how he thinks sometimes, it's like, who would want to worship something that is completely accessible and on my level, to put it that way? And so when I read the Bible, I fully expect to be challenged in some of the things that it asks of me and that it says are right. Some of them are relatively easy to accept, meekness and humility and things like that. Other things, depending on the time period in which we live, are a little more difficult to accept and may take some wrestling with before we come to terms with them. I'm fine with that. I think that's actually important. I think it's a critical part of the quality of the Bible that it stretches me and it challenges me at different stages of my life. It challenges me in different areas. But if this Bible was completely predictable to me, if you've read the Chronicles of Narnia by C.S. Lewis, it talks about Aslan, which is the lion. One quote that's always struck me is one of the characters is talking about him and saying he's a wild lion after all. That he just, we can't put God in a box and say that, oh yeah, I completely understand God's thinking. You know, yeah, we're completely on the same plane. He is and always will be somewhat beyond us. It will always be a little challenging, I think, in some ways, to follow the God of the Bible. Anyway, as I said at the beginning, I don't think that the type of conviction that the Bible asks us to have is something you're going to get listening to a 45-minute talk. You need to read it, but you need to be asking yourself as you read it, is this something that I can believe in? Is this something I can trust, that I can be part of? And I just like to come back to, you know, one of those ethical or value things that we might question is, why are the wages of sin death? Like, that seems harsh, seems hard to accept. Now, why is that? Why are the wages of sin death? Is that an expression of the harshness of the God of the Bible?
God is consistent.
Consistent. So,
that back in Genesis, that's the wages of sin was death. So what would you expect?
But why would he even say that? Why does that have to be true? Okay. Why does death have to follow sin? Okay. We're getting there. So, yeah, like, it's part of the integrity of God is that when I said before that life isn't something that God has, life is something that God is, God's character is inseparable from his life. Maybe in some other universe there is a place where certain qualities can be separated from life, and eternal life, which is the kind of life that we're talking about here, is life that never ends. Maybe there's some other place where life, where there's a God who can grant life and it's not part of him. But the universe that we know, God says life is something that is within him. In sin, what sin is the qualities or characteristics or behaviors that are alien to who God is. And so the wages of sin being death, it may seem harsh, but it is completely consistent with who God is. He's here. He has life. He has always had life, and his life is inseparable from his character. And what he says to us is, if you think my character is something that you should follow, if you think it's something that you agree with, then I will share my life with you too. And so, how does God deal with sin? So if we want to be like God, if we aspire to be like him, if we trust him and we believe in him and we agree that the way he is good, what does he do with sin? He will forgive it. He will erase it. And so we're never going to be exactly like God. But if we trust him, if we believe him, if we love him, and we love his son, he'll take care of the problem of sin. He'll take care of the problem of death. And he will share with us the life that is in him. Any questions? Comments? Anything to add? Okay, let it go. Thank you.